Okay. What? Hey, how's it going? Hi. What is time even? I finally sat down tonight to be like, okay, I'm just going to get that Ricky Close episode that I did up, the audio version of it up. The video version live stream has been on YouTube now for 4 weeks because apparently I recorded this episode 4 weeks ago. I don't know what's going on in my life lately, everyone, but time is really, it's like warping somehow. It just feels like the weeks are going by so quickly. I saw that this episode, that I did this conversation with Ricky 4 weeks ago, and I was like, how? When? I did the episode, I did the live stream on YouTube, and usually I'll just record the intro and outro later that day, but like part of the episode that I did with Ricky is I wanted to do this little personality quiz to do at the end, and I was also heading out of town the day after I did the interview portion of the episode with her. I was going out of town, I was driving to Utah for a couple weeks, so I was like, I'll finish it in Utah while I'm out of town. And then I just didn't. I got busy because I was in town doing a few things and seeing family and a movie that I'm in premiered, and I went to go see that and all this stuff. And I was like, I'll finish it when I get back home to LA. But I'm finally doing it, and somehow it's 4 weeks later. It just doesn't feel like 4 weeks went by, let alone the fact that 3 months have happened in 2024. I just, like, when? What? What do you mean 3 months? Huh? Nuh-uh. Come on. Come on. I'm still trying to get my legs underneath me for 2024. I'm still trying to, like get on solid ground here. And we're 3 months deep. The first quarter is, it's over? We did the first quarter? Okay. Oh my God. Anyway, whatever. I'm sorry. We're back. I hope you're back with us still. I hope you hung in there. You know, as a treat, since we've been gone for a minute, let's do something we haven't done in a while on this show. Let's do a little
review the review. Review the review.
That's right. Review the review. That's right. Review the review. It's the segment on this show where I read your reviews from Apple Podcasts and I review the reviews. Now, the rules of the show are you have to rate this show 5 stars. That's the only way I'm guaranteed to read your review, okay? If you don't read it 5 stars, then I don't need to read it. But if you rate it 5 stars, then I will read your review on the show and I will review it back. We've actually got a bunch backlogged here. I don't know if I can get to all of them. I might have to split this up over a few episodes because I haven't done this segment in a while. But if you'd like to participate, you can still go over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review to be on the review portion of the show. So let's do a few of these, though. From March 12th this year, this is a review from a person named Ditch Hall. Cool name. And the title of this review is Great Stuff All Around. 5 stars. And the review reads as follows. I enjoy Austin's work across various platforms. Funny, creative, thoughtful. He's doing good work and he deserves more recognition and audience for what he's doing. Check him out. Okay, thank you very much, Ditch Hall. And what I will say about this review is I agree. I do. You know, I do deserve more recognition and audience for what I'm doing. What's the deal? What do I got to do over on YouTube to get more audience over there? What does the YouTube algorithm need to see from me? Because I actually think I'm doing some of my best work as a content creator that I've done since I started doing this full time as my job. In the last like year, I've been making YouTube exclusives. I've been making video essay style, long form YouTube videos. And I actually think that they're getting better and better and better, specifically the ones that I've made so far in 2024. They've been sharp. They are well written. They're pretty well researched. They're pretty thoughtful. If you like this podcast, if you like the way that I spit off the top of the dome in this podcast, you're going to love the YouTube exclusive content where I'm actually sitting down and writing a script and I'm actually structuring my thoughts, and I'm actually putting together visuals and stuff like that. And it's fun. There's jokes. It's a fun time. Some of the episodes are really lighthearted. I did an hour-long episode where I just say the entire plot of the movie Argyle and talk about how bad Argyle is, and that's a really fun, just a fun hour of your life. It's definitely more fun than watching the movie Argyle, but also some of them are really serious. My most recent one is called All or Nothing, The Problem of Binary Activism, and it talks about, you know, Israel and Palestine and the genocide that's happening in Gaza, and it breaks down why I think we need to allow activism and advocacy and allyship to be spectral, and, you know, calling... saying that activism and allyship needs to be all or nothing, needs to be this binary proposition of you're either all in or you're not in at all, isn't productive or helpful to the cause. And it's a whole breakdown on that that you can go check out on my YouTube. There should be more people on that YouTube. I agree with Ditch Hall. So thank you, Ditch Hall. Let's check out this one. I really liked this one. This is from Sloan Nice Girl. This is all the way back in from October 3rd, 2023. That's my mom's birthday, by the way. Shout out Julie Archer. So on my mom's birthday, Sloan Nice Girl wrote, "What the title of the review is, What Do I Do Now? 5 stars. I'm so impressed with this review right off the bat. I'm going to say that before we even read it. But this is what it says. Over the last couple of weeks, in parentheses, or maybe over a month now, I have had the joy, nay, the honor, to listen to your podcast from episode 1 to the latest episode where you are pacing and talking about the film festival in Canada. Can you imagine my feelings? There's too many to name, just like there's probably too many reviews to do. Review the review, review the review. That's written out in the review. The evolution of RTR and BTB, we also need to bring back BTB, that's the Bad Take Brigade, we gotta bring that back, and we will. The evolution of RTR and BTB were legendary. If you've been here from the start, you know what Sloan is talking about right here, that those bits kind of grew and evolved into the show. Thank you for that and sharing your life, Austin. What do I do now? That's a silly question. I know what to do, and you know what I can do. Be good, Sloan. So my review of this review is, it is a 5-star review. 5 stars for this review. I'm so impressed that in the space of, you said maybe a month, you listened to like 160 episodes of my podcast. That's because the podcast probably average like 80 minutes. So we're talking like close to 200 hours of me talking on this podcast Sloan listened to in like a, that's, I hope it wasn't just a month, because that almost sounds like the kind of thing that could maybe drive you to full-blown homicidal insanity. But like, wow. Wow. And I do, like, I'm glad I'm bringing back Review the Review, and I think we need to bring back the Bad Take Brigade as well, because those were good segments, and I'm glad that those got built into the show as well. But boy, like, has anyone out there been listening since episode 1? Has anyone done what Sloan has done and gone all the way through every single episode of this podcast? Surely some people have. Our listening numbers, like our downloads weekly, have remained pretty consistent for the over 4 years that I've been doing this show. So it would stand to reason that it's been mostly the same people. So actually probably most of you have been listeners this whole entire time. So wow, thank you to all of you. Amazing. Amazing that you've all been hanging around this long. We're going to read more of these on next week's episode, but I do want to read one more here, and this is going to be breaking with the form of Review the Review, because like I said, you know, the rules of Review the Review are you have to rate the show 5 stars in order to get on the show, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to read any reviews that aren't rated 5 stars. It's just that I don't have to if I don't want to, but right now I actually do want to read this one because it is maybe my favorite review that I've ever gotten on this show. And it's from Hollering Mystic. This is from March 26th, 2024. This is the most recent review for this show. And the title of the review is Shouldn't Be Doing Interviews, 1 star. Okay. And here's the body of the review. Maybe he's gotten better since I only listened to his 2022 interview with Kyle Gallner, but I spent the whole 90 minutes irritated with Austin Archer's self-obsession. The first 20 minutes were about his TikTok, which he also interrupted his interview subject to talk about more. It felt especially disrespectful that he left in the part where he asks Gallner to move his mic. But maybe Archer doesn't edit his episodes at all. And that's it. That's the review from Hollering Mystic. And it's just, I don't know, like, I have this illness in my brain, in my bones, in myself, that I seek this stuff out and I love it. I saw this and I was immediately drawn to it like a magnet. I internalize and drink in and believe in these words so much more than I believe in any nice thing that any person has ever said about me. When I read this, my brain immediately goes, that's the truth. That's the truth. Hollering Mystic is telling the truth. You are a self-absorbed narcissist who shouldn't be doing interviews because you can't help but talk about yourself. And the other person is just there to sort of like maybe talk a little bit about themselves when mostly what's happening in the interview is you're just showing off. I am self-aware enough to understand that that is just my self-destructive ego talking, and my like the part of me that wants to self-destruct wants to believe these words. I also think it's just fascinating. I think it's so fascinating having this job for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years of my life. The amount of strangers on the internet who feel compelled to offer creative feedback on my videos, on my podcasts. YouTube's a whole trip. Doing YouTube content, every single episode, there's someone piping in, letting me know how to be a better video essayist, like how to edit my videos better, how to like almost unilaterally, someone will tell me that the videos are too long or they have too much padding. There's too much front loading on them. And this is not the majority consensus opinion in the comments. Usually the majority consensus opinion in the comments for anything that I make, whether it's TikTok or Instagram or YouTube or this podcast, is overwhelmingly positive. I mean, that's the nature of these ratings on Review the Review here on Apple Podcasts. The consensus overall over the last 4 years is that this show has an average of 4.9 out of 5 stars from everyone who's ever rated it, and we have about 200 people who have ever rated it. Obviously, the big thing about these ratings are I tell people, go rate the show 5 stars, and I'll read your review on the show. So it's a little bit skewed in my favor. But I would venture a guess that like most of the people who listen to this show regularly don't mind my style and don't mind listening to me. But like, that's the fun thing about publishing my face and my voice to this wide internet audience every single day of my life is that I'm, of course, inescapably putting my voice and my face out to people who are going to see it and be instantly turned off by it, who are just going to instantly be like, I don't like this guy. I don't like it. He thinks he's funny and I don't think he's funny. I don't like the way that I can tell he thinks what he's saying is funny. I don't like that. Or like, he thinks he's smart. I can tell that this guy really likes the sound of his own voice and really thinks that like people should be listening to him because he's got something important to say. And I don't like that. I don't like how into this guy, into himself this guy is. Or, you know, just whatever the reason. Or they see my face and I've literally had people in the comments be like, I can't explain it, but your face is hideous to me. And it's just like, okay. Okay. And of course I have that part of my brain that's like, that's the truth. That's the truth. That person is being honest. You have a disgusting face. You have a really off-putting voice and a really off-putting nature to your character. And, you know, every mistake that I make in life reaffirms this for me. The reason I talked about time being crazy is like, I feel like I've just been getting my feet under me in this year, in 2024. It feels crazy to me that we're 3 months in because I've just, the last several years of my life, I start every year the same way. I buy this giant calendar. I buy this big paper. They sell them at Target. They're these like big, giant paper calendars that go on your wall. And I start the year off buying my new calendar, and I start filling out my first few months of like what I have to do. And that's been sort of my way of keeping myself on task the last few years. I can't keep a good calendar in my phone. I won't look at it. Even when notifications come up, I will just push them away. There's too much stuff happening on my phone as it is. I don't need more things happening on my phone. My phone is always barking at me for something, and I don't need it to be even more things. So I'm trying to limit the amount of dings and buzzes my phone makes in a given day. It's already way, way, way too much. But that being said, there are very few ways that my brain will allow me to keep a good calendar. And for several years, I was keeping a pretty good calendar on this big paper calendar. And something happened in like October or November of 2023, where I just stopped checking in with my big paper calendar. And then when it came to the end of December 2023, I did not re-up and buy my new big paper calendar from Target again. I just didn't go get it. And so I've just been rocking for like 5 or 6 months on vibes and just being like, I think I know what I'm supposed to do this week. I'm pretty sure. And I'm like checking text messages and being like, let me double check on this text message of what I said with Colin and Kara when I said we're going to shoot next week. Oh yeah, that's right. Let me double check on this text message of when I'm going to therapy next. Oh yeah, that's right. Let me double check on this text message of this text reminder of this dentist appointment that I have. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. And like, you know, that vibes method is how I lived my life that way for most of my adult life, is just off of vibes. And it does okay maybe 80, 85% of the time. Like I'm pretty good at it. Pretty decent, but it goes poorly often enough that I should know by now. At 36 years old, I should know that it's just not good for me to operate this way, because what invariably winds up happening is I can put 2 or 3 or 4 solid weeks together where the vibes method is working, and I'm showing up for all of the appointments that I need to show up for, and I'm even showing up on time. But then invariably there will be a day where something will slip through the cracks. And what I always have to hope is that whoever got accidentally nudged out will be cool with it, that I can just send them that text and be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I slipped my mind, I double booked. And they'll be like, no problem, we'll do it again another time. And sometimes they are, but sometimes it is a problem. Sometimes people are like, no, I canceled a different thing so that we could do this. No, you can't just blow me off the day of. And that's a totally reasonable reaction to me being disorganized and flaky. Moral of the story is I do something like that. I did something like that today. I accidentally had to blow a friend off, and she was really, really upset with me about it. And rightfully so. But I do that, and then I read that review. I read that one-star review from Hollering Mystic, and I go, that person's 100% right. I'm a total piece of shit. I'm a total mess. And I haven't listened to that Kyle Gallner episode since I published it in 2022, but you know, there's a very good chance that I am talking about myself too much in that interview, in that episode. I definitely am talking about myself in the intro to the episode, just like I am right now. That is sort of the format for this show. Maybe that person didn't know that. I do a little like recap on what's going on in my life, maybe a little review the review, maybe a little bad take brigade, and then we get into the guest, if we have a guest on that week's episode. Also, you know, it's part of the format of this show that like, it's not so much an interview show as it is a conversation show. So it's more or less like whoever my guest is in conversation with me. I'm not Larry King. I'm not Charlie Rose. I'm not Diane Sawyer. I'm not sitting people down for like an interview with hard-hitting questions. I do ask my guest questions, but I am trying to be more in the Dax Shepard, Marc Maron vein of things, where it's like we're in conversation with each other. We're sort of co-hosting the show together. But, you know, yeah, not that guy's cup of tea. And boy, does my ego love latching on to any evidence it can to prove that I'm a terrible person. And that's enough for the intro of this show. I think. Let's actually get into what the episode is. Ricky Close. Ricky Close, I just followed her back on Instagram recently, and she DM'd me this really nice thing and was like, "Oh my God, I've been following you forever. I'm such a big fan." And then I looked at her profile and I was like, "Oh, you talk a lot about attachment and attachment theory and attachment styles. This is something that keeps coming up in my life that my friends are talking about. My therapist has talked to me about it." So I asked her if she would come on the show and tell me about attachment. And that's what she did, because she's written about it. She's written books about it. She has a podcast about it. So that's, we're going to learn all about attachment theory and attachment styles from Ricky Close today. So let's do that. From a Blankenfoot recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my new friend, Ricky Close, about attachment. And we're live on YouTube. Yeah, and for some people, it's going to be in their Spotify or their Apple Podcasts or whatever it is that they're listening to us on, or maybe they're listening to us several days later on YouTube, whatever. We're live. We're here. Ricky Close is here. I just learned how to pronounce your name.
Yeah.
Where is that? What is the genesis of Close, spelled C-L-O-O-S?
Yeah, it's German. I'm pretty sure it's German anyway. There was stories about it. Maybe it used to be pronounced Cluse, but then the ancestors changed it to make it sound more American. But I don't know how much truth there is to that. Mm. It's close and it's hard to spell. That's and that's how it is.
I've never seen it before, so I saw that and I was like, oh, like, you know, Glenn Close, but that's spelled, I think,
differently.
I think
she spells it. She spells it differently, I think, doesn't she?
The way the word Close is spelled, I think.
It's the way it should be spelled. Yeah, that's it's a rare last name.
There's no way a word should be spelled. There's a common spelling and there's an uncommon spelling, maybe, like, you know, that. But yeah. Anyway, it's nice to meet you and be face-to-face with you over the internet. We sort of met just recently in the DMs on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I always like to meet people who specialize in something that I am aware of, but I like don't know as much about it that I'd like to know. And that these episodes are exciting for me to have a guest on where I can go, let's talk about this thing that I know is very present in the zeitgeist that people talk about a lot, but that I don't actually, I have not spent the time
that's
educating
cool.
myself.
Well, I love talking to newbies about attachment theory. It's my favorite topic. So hopefully that comes through in some of the stuff that I say.
I mean, I've been single for the last 2 years, just dating in that whole world. And it definitely comes up a lot. Like it's and it's something
it's
where I'm
buzzword.
Like, oh, yeah, I should, it's like, I should know more about
it. It's nice
it.
To know.
Yeah. I have been learning. I've been learning more about like astrology and like what like my sign means and how it interacts. You know, like I've been learning more.
Any of that.
Well, and see, and like that's a thing that comes up a lot too. So I'm like, well, I just want to be able to like have some kind of footing to talk about it. But this is going to help me now because I can take this into dates and I can go like, well, now I know something about attachment styles and you know, and
sound all fancy and educated. Yeah,
attachment
it'll be great.
Theory. let's talk a little bit about sort of what brings you into this world. You're self-described in your social media as like an attachment and relationship writer. Give us a little bit of like background on like what first brought you into this. What first got you interested in this? And
cool, I can do that. And that'll lead into more of what attachment theory is. That'll be a great transition there.
Right.
For most of my adult life, I was in marketing and I got my degree in nonfiction writing. So like content creation, content writer, things like that. A lot of graphic design. And I just had a pretty normal life until one day, 12 years into my relationship, I found myself suddenly divorced and I had no idea why and what happened. It happened very quickly. I kind of realized that the marriage had been a bit of a house of cards because we had lots of underlying issues that we didn't realize because we didn't talk about any of it. So when it finally all came to a head, everything kind of disintegrated under our feet. And I'm standing there in the blast zone post-divorce going, okay, I'm sure that I was 50% of this, but I'm not sure how. So I grabbed every book that I could possibly get my hands on like couples counseling and communication. And I stumbled upon attachment theory. And as I was reading it, every single bell was ringing in my head, like, oh my God, that's me. That's what, like, all the pain points about it, about insecure attachment, were the things that had slowly chipped away and crumbled my poor marriage. And so what I did, I love psychology. I always have. That's almost what I majored in the first time in college. So then I just started grabbing psychology textbooks and just consuming everything I could find from the experts on attachment theory. And I slowly started to find that the relationships in my life post-divorce were getting better. And they weren't just getting better, but they were like fun and easy and amazing. The work itself was difficult trying to address that stuff. But every time I did, it's like even non-romantic relationships were becoming easier. I was becoming more confident and happier. And I was like, God, this is like magic. Like, I want other people to also go out and read 60 relationship books. And then I was like, wait, regular people aren't going to do that. I wish there was like maybe a writer who could like condense the really good stuff into something that's easy to understand. And then my friend was like, Ricky, you have a writing degree. Like, what do you,
what if,
like,
you're the writer?
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to write a book on all the things that helped me to overcome my anxious attachment, and see if, you know, start a little social media account, see if that sticks. And it did. Apparently I have a knack for talking about it, because I'm still here, still writing about it. My audience is fantastic. I love talking to them about it. And then sometimes I get to talk to non-relationship space people such as yourself. And even in the real world, I'll be like out to dinner with friends and someone will be like, what's attachment theory? And I'm like, ah, here we go.
You're like, that's the $1 million question. And I am. Yeah. That's my cue. Here we go. You know, there's a few things that I hear in there that I'm really, that I like want to highlight and just say I'm sort of impressed by. One is like 12 years is
a long one.
Is a significant relationship. Like, that's, I've never made it past three and a half is my high watermark. That's the longest I've ever gone. And
that's
so when
not
I,
bad. That's,
no, but I mean, like, wild. When I hear people like who are like, oh man, what happened to this relationship? I'm like, I don't know. Like, in my mind, I'm like, you did it. And sometimes things are just like, after 8 years, it's like, I think that's it. I think we've like done all the things together. You know, like 12 years is like, you did a good job. You had a night, like, you were,
we had a solid run.
You were committed enough to that thing to continue seeing it through year after year for over a decade. And then the other thing I heard that I really, really liked is like this acknowledgement of like, I'm sure that there must be, you said, I'm at least 50% of this, but even just the willingness to acknowledge yourself at all in what contributed to a relationship not progressing in the same way anymore. I think that, again, being in the dating space, a big red flag for me is if you talk to, especially dating in your 30s, everybody's got exes.
Everybody has a psycho ex. That's the,
and everybody's got like significant time with an ex. Like,
oh yeah, yeah.
It's very rare to meet a person who hasn't spent some amount of significant time with another person. And a big red flag for me is if the person only talks about their exes as like every relationship was that person's fault. It's like, well, you know, like we were living together and everything was great, but he just couldn't do blah, 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 blah. You know,
right,
it's like,
right.
Okay. And where were you in it? Were you just sitting around being the perfect partner? And
exactly. You nailed it. That is a giant red flag. People who can't take accountability for their contribution. Relationships are dynamics. You know, it's never just one person bringing the ship down. It takes two people to steer it. So I mean, if you're only... Like,
definitely. I want to put the caveat that, like, definitely there are people who have just been, like, unfortunate enough to be in relationships primarily with people who are just... significantly more harm to the relationship than they are.
Yeah,
like I just keep finding myself with people who are very harmful people who, you know, and it's like for sure that happens. But also, I just when I talk to a person about a relationship that they went through that didn't seem like it was heavily abusive in any major significant way, but all they can talk about is how their partner was the root of the problem. To me, I go, I'm sure that the things you're saying have validity to them. And I'm sure this person being the person who experienced it, there's validity there. But I just, I instantly recognized that when you said, geez, how can I look into this and find my accountability here? I was like, well, that right there is a very interesting trait, that curiosity, that introspective curiosity.
Yeah, a green flag in the dating field too. People love that. If you're able to look at what you do and be open about that, like, here's how I contributed to the downfall of my marriage. So like, okay, this person's put some thought into this, and it might be something that they're not going to repeat in the future because they've put a lot of time and effort into figuring it out.
What do you think it was about attachment theory that for you stood out while you were doing all of this studying and trying to rehash the relationship and take account for things? What do you think stood out about this from the other things?
So I wonder if I can do this without getting into what attachment theory is. They're one of the,
I think you can go ahead and get into it.
Could I?
Okay. Yeah, you can get into it.
Maybe I can do both of those at the same time and I'll say that's what stood out for me.
Yeah.
So, attachment theory, is basically a fancy way of saying that we experience close relationships as babies. The way that we experience close relationships as babies influences how we connect with romantic partners as adults. That's the little short Reader's Digest version of it. So the way that we are connecting with our caregivers as infants, it kind of wires our brain to think, okay, this is how safe and responsive the world feels to my cries for care. It ends up throwing us into three different categories of thinking about the world and feeling about the world. You've got, our two main categories, secure attachers, which are people who feel comfortable with intimacy. They trust their partners. They're pretty good at expressing their needs and navigating conflict. And part of that is having a household that you grow up in where that stuff's very healthily modeled. Parents are very available. They're very in tune with their emotions and your emotions. And then on the other side of the coin, about 50% of people fall into insecure attachment. So that's a very large percentage of people, you'll note. So if you're sitting here listening to this going, oh, I feel so broken, that's like 50% of people. So you're in great company if any of these bells are ringing for you. The insecurely attached are those as babies who didn't get kind of their core emotional needs met from parents, sometimes even physical needs too. But those are babies that thought, oh, this world doesn't seem very safe. So there's two ways that infants can deal with that. They can either become hypervigilant for signs of abandonment. They're constantly on the lookout to see if mom and dad are going to respond to their needs. In their mind, if they don't stop looking for danger in intimate connections, they're going to miss the dangerous things. So these folks end up kind of clingy. These are the anxious attachers. That's how I was. That's what brought down my marriage. And those are my people that I talk to online all the time. On the other side of the coin, in that insecure sphere, we've got avoidant attachers. So you probably will hear about them being demonized online, which is very unfortunate because those are the babies who, in their perception, their caregivers were not consistent enough for them to feel like they can depend on them at all. So their mode of safety was to just kind of retreat into themselves. Like, I am the safe place. The rest of the world really isn't. You find those people become like hyper independent. They're really uncomfortable with intimacy. They struggle to express emotions because emotions didn't get received well in their family of origin. They're not demons. They're just folks who don't view the rest of the world as safe. in an intimate way. And then throwing it back to the anxious folks, me, we don't view ourselves as safe. So for us, the rest of the world is where I need to get my safety. So that's why they're clingy and they're chasing people, because they don't have any internal safety. To where the, now I feel like I'm kind of losing it, but
I think that I think you're right. I asked the question, like, what about this stood out? And I think you're right that we can't actually fully express that without getting into some of what it is. Yeah. And I think that's all right. Let's start there. Let's talk because obviously if we're introducing this to people who are listening, I think we need to lay a framework of like what it is that we're talking about.
It
feels, and this is me just entering, like if I'm hearing this for the first time, and this is not the first time that I've heard someone break down attachment theory, but if I'm really trying to listen to it like it's the first time that it's ever been said to me, it sounds very binary, especially like a 50-50 breakdown. You're either this or this. You're either, anxious or avoidant. You're either secure or insecure. And then in my experience, for me, it feels like most things are spectral. And so where does spectrum enter into the chat here?
Yeah. Okay. I love it. I'm so glad you brought that up. Okay. So that is an overly simplified way of talking about and viewing attachment theory. It's good as an introduction, but when we really dig in, attachment occurs along a spectrum. You hardly find anybody who's primarily one way or another way. And even the secure folks will venture into the insecure territory every now and then, because humans are super complicated. Brains are very complicated, right? When I was looking into this stuff and they were bullet points listed about the thoughts and behaviors of people who were primarily anxiously attached, I hit every single bullet point. And that's why I was like, this seems to be my primary way of dealing with the world and intimate relationships. Now, that's not to say that I don't have instances where I definitely view other people as unsafe. It's also dependent, just to make it even more complicated, it's also dependent on the specific relationship. For example, in my marriage, I was very anxiously attached to my ex-husband, who was very avoidantly attached, meaning the strategies and ideas that I had about that relationship were very kind of clingy and desperate and chasing. And the primary thoughts and behaviors that he had in that relationship were very closed off, protect myself. I don't have that kind of relationship with, say, my best friend. I'm not anxiously attached to my best friend. I feel very comfortable bringing up difficult topics with him. I feel very comfortable exploring my own personal time without feeling like I need to keep track of where he is with him. So that's where you get the spectrum too. The internet loves to pick out a label and go, this is me. And they put it on and say, this is my whole worldview and how I operate. Attachment theory is so complicated. The thing that it is a great guideline. If you're looking into insecure attachment and you're seeing thoughts and behaviors that aren't working well for you, you can go, ooh, why do I think that way? Okay, attachment theory tells me that I might be thinking this way because of this. Well, I'm going to pick a different path. We are, and that's another fun thing, this may be too early in the episode for this, but attachment is not like personality traits, which tend to be very stable over the course of our life. You know, if you're kind of studious and introverted, you're probably going to be like that when you're an old person too. But if you're anxiously attached or avoidantly attached, there's so much that you can do to learn different ways of thinking and behaving so that that's not the primary way that you deal with relationships anymore. So that kind of, along that spectrum, we can scoot ourselves closer to security.
Okay, while we're talking about spectrums and the difference between binary and spectral, there's a question that somebody asked in the chat, and I wonder if you know about this. They said, Ricky, is it true that generally speaking, women are more likely to have anxious attachment and men are more likely to have avoidant attachment if they're insecurely attached?
That is true. I hate that fact. It is true, but I do think that there could be some social conditioning with that, you know? in general, it's more favorable for men to seem very stoic. You know, it's society kind of rewards men when they stuff their emotions down. So that, I don't know, if you're a child and you're getting rewarded for toughing things out instead of expressing yourself, it makes sense that you would lean more toward that when the stuff hits the fan in a relationship. The same with women. If you're taught that your worth it is found in how soon someone calls you back, it makes sense that you would default more toward anxious patterning. But at the same time, they've done attachment studies in other cultures that don't have as much of that. And they do tend to just find that avoidant attachment does tend to show up more in men. And it does tend to show up, anxiousness does tend to show up more in women. But at the same time, a full 20% of my audience of anxious attachers is male. So I'd say that's a lot of people. It's not like there are no men that suffer from anxious attachment. And I know tons of women in my own personal life who struggle with avoidant patterns.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're so right to bring up socialization and even looking at other cultures where maybe they have a different system of socialization and different things that inform that. There could still be anthropological things that you go back and just go, well, this is that there's something evolutionarily beneficial to stoicism in men in a general sense
it's baked
in at a genetic level of like you need to be self-sufficient and then be baked in at a genetic level of being someone who's waiting for the hunting party to come back and being like, right, I'm not safe until these people come back and bring the food back.
I
don't know, that's me literally just but I also think,
you nailed it.
Of course, like most things that are that we try to divide in some kind of societal binary across men and women, of course it's going to wind up being spectral, and of course there's going to be overlap and
so many different factors. The textbooks do talk a lot about possible evolutionary reasons why it seems to be avoidance shows up more in men. But at the same time, we don't know that for sure. It's all theory, but it's very interesting to read about and think about too.
Yeah. Okay. So that's like a decent, I think, primer ground level, elementary working analysis of what attachment theory is at a base level.
Awesome.
What about, so let's try to get into this. What you're reading about this, you're trying to figure out what happened in this marriage, this thing that was really important to me. What about this is standing out to you apart from the other literature that you're reading, apart from the other theories that you're reading on relationships? What's standing out to you and making you go, this is the thing that I think I want to invest in?
Well, what was tough for me was recognizing that not only were all the bullet points applying to me as I was in my marriage, but all the bullet points applied to me as I was when I was dating before I met my husband, and all of them felt very true to me even before I was out, you know, in high school and college dating people. It's just everything about it. I was like, this is the way that I relate to people in intimate relationships. I do tend to be clingy. I tend to be insecure. I feel like I message them more often than they message me. I do whatever I can so that they're happy and that they like me. You know, I like sacrifice all of my wants and needs so that the other person feels like the relationship is somewhere they want to be, like low self-worth, all the things, just every single bullet point. I knew I'm kind of a go-getter. So when I saw that, I was like, okay, I see it. And the literature is pretty sparse, or at least it was about 5 years ago, on what I can do about this. But there are some things that I can do about it. So I'm going to do everything. So I just grabbed everything that I could find. It's like, oh, the anxiously attached tend to like gravitate toward passive communication. And so I go out and I buy a book on assertive communication, you know, or it's like, oh, the anxiously attached don't have a strong sense of personal responsibility. So then I go out and I find a book on that. And I really just threw absolutely everything that I could find at it. And I stumbled upon the realization, not the realization, I stumbled upon the literature that told me there's something called earned secure. So if you start out insecurely attached and you head towards secure attachment and you make it like your predominant way of dealing with the world is a secure one. You're very, you feel lovable. You feel confident speaking up for what you need. You're not chasing anybody because you don't feel the need to anymore. You're not afraid in relationships. You then get that wonderful categorization of earn secure toward the, anyway, now I feel like I'm rambling.
You're not at all. And I'm wondering, so here's my question then, because now I'm wondering, could earned secure be mistaken for avoidant? If a person's in earned secure. So let's say that a person has arrived at an earned secure position where they're like, I no longer have to chase. I no longer have to be sending a text every day to make sure you still like me. But then that other person's going, you don't reach out. You're not checking in. You must be avoidant. You know, right. And they're
That's
reading.
Sure. Totally. Yeah. I love it. I'm glad you said that. Okay. When I say I'm in an earned secure place now, I'm not dating right now, but if I were, I can talk about how I would act if I were. I'm very comfortable reaching out as often as I want to, as often as I feel like it. You know, I'm very comfortable saying, hey, I really like what's going on here. I would love, do you want to hang out tomorrow? And they'll go, no, tomorrow's not good. And I'll go, well, maybe Friday then, you know, like I don't have the hangups. I'm not trying to protect my space. Like I'm open because I'm digging this person and I'm perfectly comfortable letting them know that because I can handle the disappointment if they don't feel the same way. Somebody deep within avoidant patterning can't handle hearing somebody say, you know, hey, I don't like this. So they're protecting themselves before any bad thing can happen to them. You know, earn secure is really like, it's all the good stuff that you can imagine. It's somebody calling you at a regular pattern, but like, not too much because they've got their other stuff going on too. But if you tell them how they feel, they're like, oh my God, thank you for telling me that. I also feel that way. Or thank you for telling me that. I'm not feeling that right now, but I could get to that point. I need some more time getting to know you. You know, or insecure would never be mistaken for avoidant. Never, ever, ever. They're very clear. I don't think they would be mistaken for that. They're very clear.
Well, I mean, okay. The reason I asked that question is because it's like, as you're describing this, I'm going, see, that's where I feel like, and I also feel like this has changed for me over time. I really do feel
like
I started off with, and I don't know the terminology well enough right now to, I think I started off in a space where I really was looking to the other person for validation really, if I liked someone, it was really hard for me to resist reaching out to them constantly and constantly checking in on them and making sure that they're still interested and still responding to me and stuff. Yeah. And then I think what happened is I got hurt enough. And so I sort of went, retreated in him, but it wasn't even that. It was more of like, I've got to make sure that I'm okay with me. I've got to make sure that I like myself. I've got to make sure that like, if I'm never in a relationship ever again, that's okay. And that I'm okay just being with me. And I've had several different periods of my life where I've really focused on that, where I've really just focused on just being alone for a prolonged period of time. And now I'm at this period of my life where I live by myself and I am dating and stuff, but I feel like I'm very communicative with people up front about the fact that I take things very, very slowly and that I have a very full life and that I will probably be available to like do something maybe once a week, you know, maybe, you know, and everyone seems to be really cool with that. But then I start feeling this thing of like, if I'm not texting regularly, they'll bring it up in ways where they'll be like, well, I mean, you're not very good at texting, the Bic. You text like a couple times a week. And I'm like, And I'm like, do I need to be texting more? But in my mind, I'm like, I think I've communicated that like I'm available as much as I'm available and that I feel really comfortable about how available I am and that I, and you seem to be okay with that too. And then they're like, yeah, no, I'm totally fine with that. I just wish you would text more. And I'm like, okay, well, those are two different things. And so then I'm going am I being avoidant and not recognizing it? Or is it possible that me just feeling comfortable with the rate at which I want to move and being really intentional with that is still being met by maybe a more anxious attachment disorder that's like, I hear you saying that, but I still want you to
Yeah, yeah. I really love that. I want to say that your attitude about feeling really good about the rate that you're texting sounds very secure. Like it lines up with your values. It's not anything that you're ashamed of. You're not doing it to purposely keep people out, right? That would be an avoidant. You're doing it because that's what feels comfortable to you. And you've also kind of communicated that to the person, like, hey, this is kind of just how much time I have available. Also, not cool of them to say that you're not good at it. You don't match up with what they're hoping to find as a texter, right? Mm. And that doesn't make you bad. You're just different than the way that they do it. So that's kind of not okay. Thank for somebody you, to shame Ricky. You for that. Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm you know what? It's actually been it's been friends, actually. So I haven't had a woman that I'm dating. Well, I've had one woman say this, but it's been friends that. Because that's another big focus in my life as a single person is really nurturing my friendships and making sure that I'm not just waiting for friends to initiate plans, but that I'm initiating and that I'm, you know, making space where sometimes I'm just getting lunch and making sure that, like, today it's just I'm going to ask my friend Marcy what's going on in her marriage right now, and I'm just going to let her sort of have the floor for the conference.
So, I love it.
You know, and I really want to put intentionality in that, but my friends will sort of razz me and be like, you're not good at texting. And I'm like, well, what is that? And in my brain, I literally think what you just said, I'm like, I think we just do it differently.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we're like, that one of us is good at it and one of us is bad at it. I just think that you have a different expectation of like how often you would like to hear from me. And
totally.
Yeah. But
do you want to hear a secure example that my friend laid on me that I was just like, that was amazing. And sure. I don't know where he learned this, but I'm late for everything. I'm like one of those people who's like chronically late. I work at home though, so that's good. It doesn't affect me very often, but it was affecting my friend who's an incredibly punctual person. And he called me one day and he was like, Ricky, I'd like to have a conversation with you about your lateness. And I was like, I was like really freaking out because I was preparing to be shamed and criticized, you know? And it just makes me happy just remembering the way that he said this. He was like, your lateness hurts my heart. He was like, I feel emotionally affected by you being late for the things that we plan with each other. It feels to me like you don't care about our get-togethers. He's like, I know that that's not true, but it feels painful. So I was wondering if you would be open to maybe we find a different system. Maybe would you be cool with me setting like a false early deadline so that we can. And I was like, I would be totally cool with that. And I'm so sorry for causing you any pain with that. Holy cow, dude. Like, I don't even know where he learned to do that, but that would be the ideal way to approach a situation like that. So if your friend is upset about the way that you're texting, instead of going, Austin, you suck at texting, like that, which is just going to shame you and not motivate you to change anything. If they came to you and they were like, Austin, I love your texts. Like, is there any way that you could like make a point to throw some more of those at me? Because your texts just like, you're so funny. They like light my day up. I value our friendship and I want some more interaction because I dig this. Like, that's a little bit more motivating than you suck at this or you're really bad at this. You should change, you know?
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. I feel like if someone was like, can you send me more texts? I would be like, I can't. Oh. I'd be like, no, I really like, I'm already maxed out on how much I can do this with my thumbs on a day-to-day basis.
And that's so, okay too. That's like, okay too.
I'll talk to you on the phone. If you want to call me up, If you want to send voice, I can do that. I can send the voice note. I just, my thumbs get maxed out on, I work on my phone and I'm answering emails and I'm responding to people's DMs on Instagram and TikTok and I'm comment.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I get, so if someone was like, I need you to send me more texts. I just like, I'm maxed out on how much my thumbs can do this on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But I do like the idea of having a conversation about it rather than just saying you're bad at this is something you suck at as a friend. Mm-hmm. And I like that more for sure. That's a terrifying thing for me. What does this mean about attachment styles? I feel like when I notice things in other people that are aggravating or irritating to me, it's reflective. Mm-hmm. I'm meant to be seeing something in them that I struggle with. And you talking mm-hmm. about time, that's been coming up for me because mm-hmm. spatial awareness and spatial negotiation has been a big thing in my life. I take these dance classes 3 times a week. And
I saw your video. You're very good.
Thank you. But I get really aggravated in class because there's a lot of us and there are some people mm-hmm. who are just newer to it than others. And there's just a thing about spatial negotiation, about like, how are we sharing the space and how are we making sure each of us has the appropriate amount of space to operate. Did you freeze and go away? Oh, you're there. Okay. Your image froze for a little bit.
Oh, I'm here.
It's fine. But I was thinking about that, like, why does this keep coming up? And I'm getting very aggravated about this and thinking about how things are reflective. And I was like, but I don't have a problem with spatial negotiation. That's why it's annoying to me, is because I'm not the one with the problem. And then I thought, well, space and time are kind of two sides of the same coin. So if I'm noticing people who have a hard time honoring and negotiating and respecting space, maybe the thing that's coming up for me is I can actually be pretty disrespectful with time. And I'm always nickel and diming my friends and people on time. I'm always, I'm always willing to be 5-10 minutes late. I'm always willing to just like that they should accept that as a tolerable amount of time to wait. And that's not that big of a deal, but it's like, all I got to do is leave my house 10 minutes earlier. It's not a big deal. I can get there five minutes early, you know? And I don't know, like what, but okay, here's my question. Here's the question. I was bringing this up to the instructor for this dance class. I told her, I was like, I'm getting aggravated in class and it's not your fault. There's nothing you're doing wrong. So, but what can I do how do I like stop being such a controlling, self-centered person in these? And she was like, have you ever just like thought of talking to someone, just saying, hey, it would really help me if you could step up, if you could like take a step forward or if you, and I was like, absolutely not. Never. I was just like, out
How
of the question.
How dare you suggest that? Yeah.
I was like, out of the question that be the guy in class that's constantly telling people to adjust their spacing. No. Mm-hmm. I would rather just be quietly mad about it for the rest of my life. But what do you think? Is that an attachment style thing that I can't conceive of a way to approach that confrontation in a way that is productive and not like an asshole?
Possibly. It does seem it is more secure to be more comfortable with difficult conversations. Insecure folks do tend to avoid difficult conversations. The avoidance avoid difficult conversations by literally avoiding them. They run away from them. The anxious folks avoid difficult conversations by people pleasing, pretending to be okay with things that they're not. Like, I'm still your buddy, but I secretly go home at night and hate you for encroaching on my space, you know? I don't know that so much of this, like, yes, certain attachment styles tend to do these things, but I wouldn't necessarily call it an attachment thing. If you're afraid of conflict or conflict averse, that's something that you can address. That's the other fun thing too. People take the attachment stuff way too literally, and that it's like, you're not a bad communicator because you're an avoidant attacher. You're a bad communicator because you're bad at communicating. There are books for that, you know, like find the behavior that's not working for you and read about it or talk to a counselor, therapist about it. We can address any of these things individually if they're bugging us.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I think that this conversation is making me realize why I've never done the deep dive on attachment theory.
Okay.
Every time it's come up and I've looked into it and someone's tried to explain to me the different avoidant versus, anxious versus
anxious.
Insecure, secure. I feel like I can see myself in all of them. I feel like I can see aspects of my, and then I go, I don't know where I land. Like, you had this experience where you were reading about anxious attachment style and you were like, that's me down the line. Like,
I had almost nothing on the avoidant side. So I was like, here's where I live. Yeah. But most people do see themselves in both columns. And secure people can see themselves. They'll look at those columns and go, okay, well, I do that. And I do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's helpful to, I mean, it's weird coming from me to say this, but I don't think it's helpful to label ourselves with a certain attachment style at all, unless everything's hitting, you know, like it was for me. Or if you're reading that, if you're reading a bullet list on avoidant attachment and you're like, oh my God, does someone have cameras up in my house? Like, this is exactly me. Then you can dive into that stuff really deeply. But man, if that's not it, and just a little bit here and there hits you, I would say address those things head on anyway. You know, it sounds like, let's see, what's a book I love for that? Difficult Conversations. Have you read that one? I don't think you have, or you would have. Okay, that's a gem.
Sounds
or you
like
would
I should
have known how to handle this. Yeah, that was mean of me. Austin, you will love that book. There's a book called Difficult Conversations. And I was very conflict averse until I read that and a number of other books on how to handle conflict without feeling like your whole world's going to crumble if it's received badly, you know?
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if you know a little bit about the history of attachment theory. It feels like this has been coming up, and I've been hearing people talk about this in my life, mm-hmm. maybe for the last like 5 or 6 years. I don't know if that's just because that's when I was introduced to it, or if it's been coming up more just in the general zeitgeist in the last 5 or 6 years. Do you know where it first originated?
I do. So this is going to get boring and sciencey for a minute here.
No, that's all right.
There's a British social scientist, John Bowlby, and he worked in, it was like a home for like severely neglected and abused boys. Mm. And he was passionate about figuring out how to help them. And he noticed there were different ways that they were acting with the caregivers in the facility. So he's like, I'm going to do some studies because I think that their behavior might have something to do with things that happened to them when they were babies. Don't all psychologists just go straight back to that, right? Mm-hmm. But he did, oh my God, he was brilliant. He wrote tons and tons of papers, did so much research, and he did find what he described as secure ways of dealing with caregivers and insecure ways of dealing with caregivers. In the same vein, there have been studies observing the caregivers, and caregivers can be contributing to this dynamic too. You might have a baby who's actually, let me pull the stuff out of my textbook reading. There's our attachment system. So that's a baby's system for calling out to a caregiver and deciding whether or not that cry was met appropriately. That's our attachment system. And then there's a caregiving system, which the caregivers have. And that is our sensitivity to what our baby needs. So you've got babies that are more or less sensitive in their attachment. I probably was a very sensitive baby, just knowing my own way that I am. I'm kind of an anxious person. I'm nervous. I would imagine that I, as a baby, would notice if mom took 1 second longer to respond to my cries than my little sister, who's super laid back. So she's probably less sensitive about that. And then let's talk about my mom real quick. She is a very nervous type of personality, but she's also very scatterbrained. So sometimes she'd come running to the crib, I'm sure, and pick me up and soothe me. And other times she was just overwhelmed with her life and didn't know how to respond. And so in that way, the development of this stuff happens kind of along a spectrum too, because you have babies that are more or less sensitive and you have parents who are more or less sensitive. And that's not to demonize anybody. We just come out differently, and the way that we interact with people kind of stamps us. And I've totally forgotten where I started with that. Where were we going with that one?
You were talking about the development of attachment theory, where it came
perfect.
From.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Good. So I'm still on the right path here. So
I'm that you thought that you were rambling. You were right on track. I wanted to say that so far.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So John Bowlby was doing this in the 60s. He eventually teams up with this lady, Mary Ainsworth, who is another psychology researcher. And Mary Ainsworth is like, hey, I love this attachment theory stuff, But I'm noticing that adults in romantic relationships kind of have these same kind of patterns. Isn't that weird? What if we studied children, you know, from an attachment perspective and followed them into their adult lives to see if these patterns are also showing up when they're adults? Or we test children and we test adults and we see if the same rates of anxiousness and avoidantness occur. And they did. They noticed that the rate of anxiety and avoidant responses in children was the correlation was kind of uncanny. So they're like, wow, we carry these patterns into our adult relationships. We don't have our parents to cry out to anymore. We have romantic relationships. They're like our stand-in parents. When we're needing soothed or comforted. And we have different ways of dealing with our romantic partners based on how our parents dealt with us.
Is it true, or is it just a matter of my personal perception that it has been gaining a certain popularity over the last 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. Amir Levine's book Attached, I actually don't know what year that dropped, but it was maybe like 6 years ago, I want to say, that I stumbled on his book Attached. And that book was like, it was like a huge bestseller. And everybody and their dog was like, oh my God, attachment theory, this is the thing. So it's really caught fire. I mean, it's definitely been around for a long time, but 10 years ago, you wouldn't see anybody talking about this in a way that, you know, everybody was excited about. That was like a boring psychology term that nobody really cared about, unless you were in the psychology world. But now everybody loves it, myself included. I'm not a psychologist and I love this stuff too.
It's interesting. You talked about labels. You were like, I don't know if it's necessarily helpful for us to fully label ourselves as this thing or the other thing when it comes to attachment styles or really anything else. I really think I could do a whole episode. I've wanted to do an episode on this podcast for a long time. I could maybe even do a video essay or something on my YouTube channel about labels and about categorization and about you know, self-diagnosis or diagnoses even, and just because I think that I'm really fascinated by the usefulness of being able to say that's what it is. That's what it is. And I think there is, obviously it's something about being able to identify a problem in order to find a solution to a problem and being able to give it a name and give it a grouping of characteristics to say, okay, these are the characteristics associated with this problem that I'm looking at. Now that I know them and I can name them, I can sort of lay them out and begin working on them. And I see the usefulness in that, but then also I, you know, there's something even deeper about like personal identification of just belonging to something and going, oh, I can find a tribe of people who share my categorization or label. And I don't know. And even there might be something in attachment theory that I have always been a person who's avoided labels heavily, that I've never felt. I mean, the reason I'm just recently getting into astrology is I'm deciding not to be so quickly dismissive of this thing rather than being like, oh God, you all just need to feel significant in some way because you have this word that's associated with the time you were born, you know, and it has the planets and whatever. But and it's like, if I can be, I don't know. I like thinking about it in a sense where it doesn't need to be so magical. It can just be as simple as like, I exist in a large room with these planets and I'm not actually functionally separate from them. My body is made up of separate molecules that have mostly empty space between them. Most of the atoms in my body have empty space between them that if you shrunk yourself down far enough, it would be as significant as the space between me and Saturn. Like it would be that, you know, it would be that far at a certain scale. And yet you zoom out and it looks like it's one solid thing. That's me. If you zoom out to the size of the Milky Way galaxy, there is no, you cannot see the space between Earth and Saturn. You cannot see the space between it's imperceptible. And so if you view it in that sort of, if you just get curious about these things and how they could be used, and that's something I'm trying to, that's why I think it's interesting to talk about this stuff too. It's just, I want to approach it with a sense of curiosity and sense instead of like, a self-righteous dismissiveness, you know?
I love that. Labels have a tendency to trap us, I think, also in a way of thinking about ourselves. It's kind of limiting. If I had grabbed onto that anxious attachment title and just wrote it off into the sunset, I wouldn't address these things. I would just go, this is me and this is how I am. And here are all the people who do the exact same thing that I do. And I belong, but I didn't do that. I found a thing and I said, all right, these are ways that I'm acting that aren't really working out for me. I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to use this label to address the problems within that so that I can be a more complete, well-rounded person that I enjoy being. I think labels can be helpful in pointing us toward a path. I don't think that they're super helpful in, I don't know. I mean, anything that makes you feel like you're trapped and you can't grow into who you want to be outside of it is probably a little problematic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because I think that another common theme here in this conversation is that the usefulness of the label is that it gives you a direction to orient the work that you're doing on trying to become a better communicator, be more effective in relationships. It's not just to say, oh, that's what I am, and therefore no one can judge my behavior because I now have a name for it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, that's what I am. But also, man, I just saw something in the chat here that I thought was really interesting. They were talking about getting to the point in your life where you realize that you don't need to be friends with everyone and that that the idea of like having a mismatch with someone and just going, oh, we're not aligned or we're not matched in a way that, and that's okay. We don't need to like each other. There's something in me, and maybe this is the anxious part of me or the insecure part of me, that it's definitely the people pleaser in me. That's the name of this podcast, is I just need to be liked by everyone. And so when I have a friend who says this or that thing isn't working for me with the way that you, I just am like, well, let me fix it. Let me work on it. I'll figure it out. Instead of just going like, oh yeah, I don't actually think that that's a problem. I think that we just aren't, connecting there. And, I just take in everyone's feedback as like, you're right. I'll get to work fixing that.
Sometimes they're not right. Sometimes they're not right. And sometimes you're doing okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Could I throw something in about boundaries and the way that boundaries is a buzzword too, but it's a good one, especially considering the name of your podcast.
Yeah.
It does tend to be that the insecure, avoidant folks tend to have very rigid boundaries. This is how I am. You will deal with it or else. Well, I'm cutting off connection, right? Those are rigid boundaries. Then more anxious folks will kind of be like, they have completely porous boundaries or no boundaries at all, right? Somebody tells you, you need to text me more. And you're like, how much can I text you? I'll text you 14 times an hour if that's what makes you happy. What we want to aim for is secure, right in the middle, where they say like, you know, this is kind of how I like to be and that's okay. But at the same time, I treasure this relationship. So what's like a compromise that still lets me be a little bit of me and still lets me open up a little bit to you so that you feel good, but I'm not losing myself. Man, it's a difficult line to toe, but it's doable. We can find a compromise and balance, not lose ourselves, but still maintain connections that are important to us by giving just a little, you know?
I love that. So if I were to try to approach a process where I'm trying to find the label or the diagnosis or the categorization for myself, what would be your recommendation for someone who's interested in looking into figuring out their personal quadrant of their space on the attachment spectrum? I know that you've got some literature that you have authored that people could look at if they want to know about it.
But I don't recommend my book unless you are either like heavily identifying with the anxious attachment side or you're dating someone like that, because it would be a great tool to figure out more about them also. The website yourpersonality.net. And they really need a marketing team because that is a terrible URL. But yourpersonality.net is run by the University of Illinois psychology department. And it's a really solid test. And when you're done with the test, it throws you onto an actual quadrant that shows you where you're at, not in black and white terms, but along the spectrum, okay. Which is great and much more healthy. It's kind of a longer test, but it's the best one. I don't recommend, don't look at any other test on the internet, because that'll be like, you are avoidant. It's like trying to figure out what Power Ranger you are. You know, that's not what this is like. We want to see ourselves on the spectrum.
What does your Burger King order say about you?
Exactly. That's not this. This is run by a psychology department at a university. It's on the up and up. The other cool thing is yourpersonality.net has you sign in. So you can like retest in a year and see your old dot and where your new dot throws you. It also has you answer questions about different relationships in your life. So you're not just answering questions about a romantic partner. You're also answering questions as you relate to your best friend or your parents. And they'll throw dots for that too. So I love that because it shows you that you're not just, I am anxious, I am avoidant. It's not like that. It's like in my relationship with my dad, I tend to be more avoidant. In my relationship with my best friend, I tend to be very secure. Mm. It's just a great test. That's the one. I don't know if you have a link that you can throw people, but gosh, I love that one.
Yourpersonality.net.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Chris Fraley, I want to say at the University of Illinois is the one who runs that. And it's
I'll put it in the description for this video on YouTube.
Cool. Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of people that'll run over there and take that after hearing mm-hmm. about this, maybe.
Yeah, cool. Amazing. And then, you know, well, if they do want to follow you and talk about attachment with you and get into what you've learned about attachment, what can they read that you've written and where can they follow you and all of those fun things?
My book is called The Anxious Heart's Guide. It's by Ricky Close. That's C-L-O-O-S. But if you don't want to be messing around with links or anything, you can find me on Instagram at Anxious Hearts Guide, I guess, or just search for Ricky Close. It's a weird name, so I probably will pop up even if you misspell it. The book's on Amazon, and the Audible version's actually doing pretty well. I narrated it, which was a lot of fun.
Cool.
And I have a new book coming out in a couple months, but it's not ready yet. It's almost ready. And that one is for folks who are in an anxious and avoidant relationship. And that's a topic for a whole different podcast episode, I'm sure.
Well, there's a chance that someone's listening to this right now, 3 or 4 or 5 months from now. Are you allowed to say what the title of the book is?
Oh, I am. Yeah, I am. It's going to be called Anxious and Avoidant Healing the Dynamic. And that'll be, of course, by Ricky Close.
So. Cool. So you might be somewhere in the future, viewer or listener, maybe. Where the book is out.
And that's true. Go, okay. Yeah. I never think about the future. These podcasts usually do live on the internet for a while, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. It's wild. I mean, people are always listening to episodes like a year later, 2 years later. Yeah. So.
Okay, cool. So it's probably out. Go look for it if you want.
This was very illuminating and enlightening in many ways, and I'm excited to look more into it and to get deeper into it. Thank you so much for making the time to jump in here and do this.
Oh, no. Thanks for having me. It was a total pleasure. Like I said, I just get your sense of humor. Like, it's just, everything you put out is funny to me. So when I got a message back from you, I was like, yes, I want to talk to this guy about literally anything he wants to talk about.
Thank you. Well, luckily I wanted to talk about the thing that you're good at talking about.
That's great. I know. I'm very lucky there. Yeah.
And thank you for saying that. You know, being a people pleaser and probably a really anxious person, it is weird. It's like, I have so much evidence in my life to suggest that there are people who think that my style of humor is funny, but I'm always wanting the approval of the people who don't think what I do is funny. In like my funny friends who like don't give me the validation that I want, that they're like the people that I respect, that I'm like, you're a comedian who, if you said that I was funny, that would mean something to me.
Yeah.
And, but it's like, It's so funny how it's never enough. It's never enough.
It's never enough to just have somebody say,
I like it. It's funny to me what you do. And I'm like, yeah, but I need
you don't
I need,
count.
The person who doesn't like it needs to be converted. They need to be right. won over, you know. I don't have any advice on that.
Yeah. That's right. Or in my brain, I feel the same way.
Yeah. Or it's like, or in my brain, they're correct. Like that's correct. You know, it's like,
everybody who likes me is wrong. And the one who doesn't, they're the ones who can really see me. Oh, that's right. I do that too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We had a very active chat. Thank you all for your comments and questions and really, really appreciate it. Somebody just said, Latter-day Daily Digest is like Corbin Allred could co-host if you wish. I can get Corbin Allred in here. Corbin's a buddy of mine. We did a movie together. I like Corbin.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. Well, anywho, I think that's about it. Is there anything else you wanted to cover or talk about?
I think we got it. I think we summed it up. I think we missed a couple of the bullet points, but I think it was meaty enough that it's okay.
I saw that and I was like, I'm all right with it. I think we did a nice ground level. Here's your introduction to attachment theory. And if you're interested, there's always more that you can go look into.
Oh,
I'm going to drop that.
More.
Yeah. I'm going to drop that link in the description of the video and all that good stuff. And thank you again, Ricky Close,
for being
here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Great. See everybody on the next one.
All right,
bye, everyone. Love you all so much. Goodbye. Bye. All right. Okay. There it is. The first new audio episode in 4 weeks. I still can't get over that. So I did take that personality test. I wound up going to the website that she recommends there, and I went and took the test, and then it sat on my, you know, just like open on my Google Chrome. It sat there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I went back when I was going to record this outro to look at it and be like, let me read what this said about me again. And it was logged out, and I couldn't remember what my login was, and it said that I hadn't created a profile, apparently, so I was going to have to retake the entire thing, and I've already taken too long getting this episode out, so I just need to put it out. But I looked at it, Ricky. and you can too. And go and check out Ricky's book, go check out Ricky's podcast, go follow Ricky on Instagram and social media and all that good stuff. And yeah, okay. That's it. That's the show. Go review it on Apple Podcasts if you want to be a part of the newly renewed, revived segment Review the Review. And maybe next week we'll even have a bad take brigade. I've already recorded another episode of this podcast. The live stream video version of it is on my YouTube right now. I'm talking with writer-director Weston Rizzulli, who wrote and directed the movie Riddle of Fire that I'm in, that you can currently go see in select cities. So, you know, just look up Riddle of Fire. Showtime's near me. There might be a Showtime near you that you can go see it at. And I'm going to be talking with Weston about filmmaking and about his movie. So tune in for that and go follow me on YouTube and all that good stuff. That's it. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Patreon.com/AustinArcher is a place where you can go support this show and everything that I do online. Thank you to all my Patreon patrons for your continued support. I really, really genuinely appreciate everything that you do so much. Okay, everybody, we'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love you so much. Bye-bye.